This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. I'm here in place of Steve this afternoon. My name is Don Nolan. I'm a retired professor of philosophy and religious studies for many years, and we also have with us in the studio Ms. Carly Nix. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks.
Glad to be back. I'm glad to meet you for the first time. I understand you've been doing this for a little while.
Just a few times so far, yep.
You're an intern at WLL?
Intern, volunteer, and also working here.
Right. Well, we are very privileged to have with us a very distinguished guest. His name is Professor Robert P. Jones, who has just written a book entitled Progressive and Religious, How Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and Buddhist Leaders are Moving Beyond the Culture Wars and Transforming American Public Life. And we're going to spend the hour talking to Professor Jones. Professor Jones, are you there on the phone?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I understand you're in Oregon, is that right?
I am.
Well, good luck in your travels around the country.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll be at Oregon State tomorrow.
Just a little bit about Professor Jones. He's the, and correct me if I get any of this wrong, you are the president of Public Religion Research and a visiting fellow in religion at Third Way, which is a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. Is that right?
That's right.
And previously you were an affiliated scholar at the Center for American Progress and the founding director for Center for American Values and Public Life at People for the American Way. Organizations and books you were involved in have long titles.
That's true. You did a nice job, though.
And then prior to your work in D.C., I understand that you were an assistant professor of religious studies at Missouri State University. Is that right?
Correct.
And I'm hoping to talk with you a little bit about something I remember from years ago, the great upheaval down in Southern Baptist Seminary. You got your Master's of Divinity from Southwestern, is that right?
That's correct, in Fort Worth.
And a Ph.D. from Emory University, yeah, I assume in religious studies, is that right?
Right.
Or religious ethics, I think it indicates here. All right. Well, you have so many more things that you've been involved in your life, but those are the key things. Let's just dive right in. You have written a very provocative book and engaging, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in whether or not we're in a, I think your term was post-religious right world, or is that the correct term?
Right.
Who invented that term? I can't remember in your book. Someone used that term. I think it's E.J. Dionne. Is that right?
Right. That's right. Yeah. Pulled out. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about why it is that we're in a post-religious right world?
Sure. Well, I begin this book really in the wake of the 2004 presidential elections and over some concerns both as a scholar, as a citizen, about the way that religion was used in that election. That election is, of course, the election that brought us the so-called values voters. And as they were conceived and invented in that election, they were characterized in two ways, as pretty much a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party, and also that concerned about two issues, opposing abortion, opposing same-sex marriage. Now, in hindsight, I really think we can see that this that 2004 election in many ways represented the high water mark of about 30 years of organizing on the part of the Christian right, and I believe represented that we have some evidence of some overreaching, really, of that agenda. It created really two reactions that set the context for the book, and one of them was that many of your listeners may be aware of is the rise of the neo-atheist voice, especially in a spate of books that came out in the wake of the 2004 elections, God is Not Great, books that were proclaiming that we should free ourselves from the God delusion and that religion poisons everything. So pulling no punches about religion. The other thing
Just interrupt you. That's Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, I believe you're referring
to. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, the second thing I think was a study of American youth that I thought was very telling that asked American youth by the Barna Group, which is an evangelical-associated polling group, what their opinions were of Christianity. And they allowed them to pick from a list of 10 attributes that were 10 positive, 10 negative attributes. They could pick anything they wanted. And what was striking is that in the things they most associated with Christianity overwhelmingly were negative. 9 out of 10 said the things they most strongly associated with Christianity were anti-homosexual, judgmental, hypocritical. Now, this is the generation that has grown up with the rise of the religious right. So I took those things.
It had become stereotyped.
Yeah, and I think the mistake that both of these kind of reactive groups had made, in my mind, was mistaking a part for the whole, right? That they had taken what had become, I mean, legitimately become the dominant face of religion in the country, but had forgotten that there's a whole other vibrant set of religion out there. So that's really what I set out to do. I set out on what became a 3-year journey that involved travel all over the country, nearly 100 interviews with religious leaders to find what I call the other religious America. And basically what I found was that there is a vibrant emerging face of religion that's moving beyond the culture wars, this divisive use of religion, and moving toward things like social justice, the common good, and rather than using religion as the tip of the spear to divide people, we're really recovering an older meaning of religion from its Latin roots, really that means to bind people together. So I found this group of people that were authentically religious, politically progressive, and this book is the first one really to, I think, paint give us a glimpse of what the new religious landscape might look like in a post-religious right America.
Let me indicate to our audience this is a call-in show, and if you have a question you'd like to put to Professor Jones about his new book, Progressive and Religious, at any time during the show, you can call in with a comment or a question. The number here at WLL is 333-9455. You can also use an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, you say you interviewed 100 religious leaders across the country that you had identified as roughly in the progressive tradition or the religious left. In your book, you distinguish those two terms. Which did you originally look for?
Right. Well, I think one of the great gifts of writing and doing research is that you're often surprised that some of your initial assumptions don't quite pan out. And that was really the case here, that when I began writing the book, I assumed, wrongly it turned out, that I was going to be writing a book about the religious left, you know, a religious left to balance out the religious right, the missing thing. And I immediately became aware when I would use this term with people that I was talking to and that I had assumed would kind of own the term and be in the religious left, an overwhelmingly negative response to that, and you know, people saying, "Oh no, that's not me. You know, we don't need a hyper politicized religious left to balance a hyper politicized religious right. We need something else from religion in the public square." One thing I try to do in the book is to really let voices come out. So I had a lot of interviews and I tried to give long block quotes where you could actually hear the voices of leaders coming out and as well tell a story. I'll let you hear just one thing on this point that I think captures what I heard from a lot of people. This is from Sister Joan Chittister, who's the co-chair of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, a progressive religious group affiliated with Tikkun magazine out on the West Coast. She said this when I asked her about being part of the religious left. She said, "I don't want to be part of anything anymore in my life that makes those boundaries barriers. I don't want to be defined as a right or left. I want to be defined as a Christian with the world in mind. The people who are really leaders are trying to move us all without internecine warfare into a very spiritual world, a very new world." So I immediately realized that I was looking at something quite different, and that was a much broader movement that's a kind of center-left, broad coalition and not kind of a much smaller faction.
Well, you indicated, I was actually surprised at these numbers, that it's a false perception that conservative religious people outnumber progressives, that it is apparently a media myth or some other kind of a myth. I think you say the conservatives are around 15% of the population compared to 14% on the progressive or religious left. How did this perception come about?
No, that's right. There's been a couple of different studies now, one that I was the author of called the American Value Survey, and the one you just cited was from Professor John Green at the University of Akron, did a survey together with beliefnet.com. And in both of those, you know, individual studies, they basically turned out that the religious left and the religious right, defined theologically, are about the same size. Now, what's happened is the more conservative religious voices have been much more organized, especially over the last three decades, have really put together a very broad media infrastructure and a kind of echo chamber and a series of institutions that really have helped push out a very kind of consistent message that I think gives them a much bigger footprint, an outsized footprint from the constituency they actually represent. And on the other side, and one of the things that we found, too, in a media study by Media Matters for America, where they looked at a year's worth of media coverage after the 2004 elections, actually found also that in the mainstream media, print and television and radio, that that actually when religion was covered, more conservative religious voices were actually featured in the media 3-1 to more progressive religious voices. So there is a misperception in the country that, but it's based on a kind of outsized footprint in the media.
You say that liberal religious voices have been drowned out for a variety of reasons. There's a section in which you list four: diversity, dispersal, timidity, and that they're overlooked. Let's just talk a little bit about the issue of diversity among the religious left. Let's just start off with this question. I guess I wasn't surprised, but why is it that 15% of evangelicals are in the progressive camp? A lot of people don't realize that there is that long tradition.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that people often don't quite realize, I think, you know, especially if you're not in the South and the Southeast of the United States, is that white evangelical Christians represent about a quarter of the country. So it's a very large group. So if you start with that knowledge and understand that's how big they are, it's not so surprising that you end up with about a fifth, you know, on depending on whether you're looking at vote or a particular issue, you end up with about a fifth of white evangelicals actually being in the progressive camp, about a third of them being in the middle, and then then the other half being consistently conservative. So there's I think the media is catching up to the fact that evangelicals are not monolithic and are a much more diverse group than they've been treated before. And I think where we're at now is also beginning to be a better understanding of a broader and diverse group of progressive religious leaders. But one of the challenges, I think, in terms of visibility is, you know, you raised this diverse question. Well, in you know, if you want to write a book about conservative religion in America, you can pretty much capture the bulk of it, not all of it, but you can capture a lot of it just by looking at one Christian subset of Christianity, white evangelical Christians. If you want to talk about the progressive religious movement in America, you have to talk about not only evangelicals and mainline Protestants and Catholics all in the Christian camp, but you also, and Pentecostals, but you also have to cover Judaism and Islam and Buddhism, and it's a much more complex group. The other thing is that that they're focused on a much broader range of issues. They're not also, you know, narrowed down just on a couple of issues. So it becomes a little harder, I think, for a public perception to come through because they're focused on the war in Iraq, they're focused on the environment, they're focused on social justice and economic justice, a broad set of issues that I think sometimes disperse the voice.
Is the religious right really as homogeneous as some say? You mentioned Green and Waldman in an article called The 12 Tribes of American Politics, who say that the religious right is composed wholly of white evangelical Protestants. I guess I I would imagine some conservative Catholics and Jews might beg to differ, and I even know a few theologically conservative Hindus.
Sure. I mean, there certainly is. There in every religious tradition in America, there are, conservative Jews or conservative, Hindus or conservative Muslims, and that's true across the spectrum. But I think what I was focusing on in the book is who has really captured the public face of conservative religion in America, and that really is white evangelical Christians who have really captured the public face for the most part. They've been the sort of most outspoken representatives on the right. One thing to want to make sure I do, too, is distinguish between they often get used interchangeably, but the term evangelical and the term Christian right, mm-hmm. That evangelicals are a quarter of the population, and as I said, they kind of break into three groups depending on how you look at them. And when I use the word, the Christian right, it really is that most conservative half of evangelical. So it's really the subset of a much broader religious tradition, the evangelical tradition.
Just a reminder to our listening audience, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, this is a talk-in show, and if you have a question to put to Professor Jones about his new book, Progressive and Religious, you can call in at 333-9455, or you can call 1-800-222-9455. Well, you mentioned another reason why the religious left or progressives have not had the megaphone of the media, and you indicate that they are widely dispersed, that since the 60s, many of them went to various service delivery organizations that did not have explicit religious missions. But I guess I'm wondering, wasn't this as much an effect of secularization as progressive religious activity, and isn't secularization part of the problem for mainline religion?
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you follow the secularization theory debates in religious mm-hmm. studies, you'll see that most of the sociologists that were hardcore about that in the 60s and were going to be pronouncing, religion dead by the turn of the century have since recanted by force of evidence.
Except for the neo-atheists.
Right, that's right, except for a handful. There's a couple that are hanging on. Peter Berger's a good example, I think, of someone who was really in on that, and then I think at some point realized it really wasn't happening in the U.S. This does go to, I think, one point that I did see, and that I think is happening, that what I think happened among many religious progressives is that they did not see the need. I think in the 60s and 70s, well, sort of coming out of the 60s, they moved into being on the boards of many social justice organizations, hunger organizations, environmental organizations, and still today, if you look at the boards of many of those, they're made up of people who indeed are progressive religious people, but they don't wear that hat when they sit on those boards. One of the things that I think is happening is a reintegration among progressive religious people of reaching back to tradition and reclaiming traditional religious practices, reclaiming the Bible, reclaiming traditional religious beliefs, and so being observant of holidays in the Jewish world, keeping kosher, going to synagogue more regularly. There's a kind of reawakening, I think, of ritual and more traditional religious practice. And this also is kind of one of the things that I think goes to the title of the book. I titled it Progressive and Religious. And one of the reasons why I wanted that "and" in there is because what I began to see is that many people were, if you look just at their religiosity, it looked very traditional. They were doing very traditional things, but yet even that very traditional religiosity was pushing them in progressive political and social directions. So that I think is a new thing going on, that there is a kind of spiritual kind of renewal going on among progressive religious people in the country.
You also mentioned timidity. I was a little taken back by that. Isn't there a difference between timidity and aversion? I guess if I were asked to appear on the Bill O'Reilly show on Fox, I think it might be repugnance rather than timidity that I would refuse. There's a saying, I think it goes, if you wrestle with pigs, you'll get mud on you.
Right.
So Was it really timidity or just what aesthetics maybe?
No, that's a good point. I mean, it may be a kind of cultural style that I think many, if you take like mainline Protestants, for example, and mainline Protestant Christians in the country, I do think there is a kind of aversion to, it is a cultural thing, like an aversion to kind of open conflict. But what I also think has happened is that somewhere along the line, and I think political progressives are actually getting a little better at this, and I think we've seen with President Obama and that whole movement, a sort of an improvement of the way that progressives talk about issues. But for the longest time, and I think particularly in the 2004 election and around there, when you would hear political progressives talk, they would talk about statistics, they would talk about, and they would make these very long and fairly dry arguments. There's a sociologist named Stephen Hart who studied progressive environmental groups in the 90s, and he was stunned at how these progressive groups seem to go out of their way not to tap people's deepest values and beliefs. And what that ended up doing is really eviscerating the power of those arguments. And I think there's a kind of turning around of that as well. And I think it's tied up with people trying to connect and really reintegrate their spiritual and political selves in a way. And so I think that this timidity factor really is shifting as well, that there are, you know, people willing to say, look, this is the way I read the Bible, and it leads me to this conclusion, that you know, and reclaiming, I think, the complexity of Scripture, for example.
At the end of the book, you talk a little bit about the recovery of passion and progressives getting over the fear of passion. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's connected to what we're just talking about. I mean, you're right to jump there, that that I think it's one of the things that that religious people who are religious and progressive can actually contribute to the broader progressive movement, that connecting to deep religious traditions that and connecting to, you know, things like Scripture, connecting to deeper values and talking about higher callings. It's the kind of thing that, Rabbi Heschel and Martin Luther King Jr., I think, did very well. But that was a whole generation ago, and I think we're now seeing another generation is coming along, and I think able to do that for our time in a way that that King and Heschel did it, a few decades ago.
Is the reason why Pat Robertson and Billy Graham and others are beat out 3-1, more progressive religious leaders on CNN, because they generate higher ratings than, say, Jim Wallis or Professor Robert Jones?
It may be. I'm not, you know, that's probably part of it. I think there has been a certain sense of, this goes a little bit to the timidity point we were just talking about, where I think many times, religious leaders, progressive religious leaders have been, you know, more circumspect on issues by nature, and are less willing to make kind of hard proclamations that sound black and white and that are very provocative. They're usually willing, wanting to be a little more nuanced than that, and that kind of comes out of their progressive faith traditions. So there's a sense in which that makes them, you know, I think less flashy in the kind of media that's about, you know, generating the spark and kind of watching which way, you know, everything flies after the sparks go. But I do think the other piece of it is that the Christian right really has built a phenomenal media structure, and so that sits in parallel to the mainstream media. So there's a sense in which there's a kind of echoing that goes on, and there isn't a similar kind of thing to that on the left at this point.
Before we go on to the next topic, I just want to make one more reminder. If you'd like to call in, talk to our guest, the number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to your background. You understand, were born and raised in Mississippi. Is that right?
That's correct.
What happened to the accent?
Well, I grew up in the panhandle of Texas, so up in the plains, and I think that is part of it, and then moved to Mississippi when I was 7.
Well, I grew up in Texas and took my drawl with me. It took a while to lose it.
Oh, well, So it's still there on certain words, but yeah, I grew up for the most part in Jackson, Mississippi, and grew up Southern Baptist myself.
And how did you migrate to Southwestern, or was it Southern?
I went to Southwestern Theological Seminary.
Is that your plan was to go into the ministry or into the?
It was going back and forth between the ministry and going into academia.
And you had a firsthand testimony of the takeover of that seminary by the Southern Baptist Convention. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, I was there in 1994. That was my last semester at seminary. Was the and for those of your listeners who don't follow inside SBC politics, a little bit of background is just there had been a kind of systematic attempt since the early 70s, really, to get majorities of trustees on various boards to kind of steer them in a more conservative direction from an already conservative direction. So really to steer them in a more fundamentalist direction. And I was there when they finally got enough votes on the Board of Trustees to fire the president and to also go set about systematically firing a set of professors who didn't meet certain litmus tests.
I'd like to talk about that in just a few minutes. We have a caller on line one.
Great.
Hello, your question?
Hi. Yes. Well, great show, and the book sounds absolutely fascinating. This question actually kind of relates to something you were talking about a few minutes ago in comparing the progressive and conservative in terms of passion and emotion and so forth. You know, I've always kind of wondered with the progressive Christians if in some ways the propensity towards sort of intellectualizing religion is a little bit at odds with the emotional or more passionate kind of take on things from the conservative side. I don't know if that rings true for you, if you found that to be the case at all, or how that may have come into play in the people that you interviewed.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great question. I think that's absolutely a piece of it, that there is but I think part of what goes, I think, along with it is a sense of humility as well, there's a kind of nuanced set of positions. It's rare on the progressive side of things to say, you know, something like God said this, I believe it, and that's the end of it. That's not typically the way progressive religious people talk. And so there's a desire to leave open some space for disagreement and argument and debate. But I think one side effect of that is that it sometimes does lead to kind of stopping short of the kind of things that we were able to hear, like I said, a generation ago, Martin Luther King speaking very powerfully, and yet, you know, not dogmatically. And I think that is the thing that we're seeing more and more of as we're moving forward. I'll give you one good example. It's one of the things I love to do about the experience of talking to all these people, that I have these great examples now. Father John Deere, who's a Catholic priest and kind of social activist, was able to really use some language. I'll give you an example of it. And this is throughout the book, I try to hold out examples like this of people who are really doing this well. Says this, and this language is not going to sound, I think, typical of what you might expect, but he says this: Christ is calling us to be citizens of the reign of God, first and foremost. We're voting, if you will, with Christ. Our citizenship is real and political, and in that reign, there's no war, there's no poverty, there's no executions, there's no starvation, there's no nuclear weapons, there's no global warming. Everyone sees one another as a sister and brother, and you love all creation itself. Now, we're supposed to believe Jesus when he says the reign is at hand here and now. I want something more than a Democrat or Republican in the White House. I want a new world. So that kind of language is really calling people to a higher vision, really without apology and without a lot of dancing around it, is one of the things that I saw as a common thread throughout the book.
Well, thank the caller for your question. I think we have another caller on line one. Your question or comment?
Yes. I tuned in a little late, so I don't know what kind of statistics the author has come up with to substantiate what he's talking about. But as a progressive, I certainly hope that we keep religion out of politics. They should have nothing to do with each other. My own personal ethic is something I will bring to the progressive movement, but I am not going to take my religion along with it because it's totally inappropriate. I think everybody has to make their ethical decisions, and I would not want to burden these ethical decisions with any religion at all, whether it is Jewish or Christian or Catholic or Muslim or Unitarian. You know, I think it just ought to be kept separate. And I would like to hear on what he bases his thesis.
Professor Jones?
Okay, yeah, no, that's a great question, great points. And I actually think this goes to something else that is right along with what we're talking about, that I think the sentiments that the caller is saying about separation of church and state is also a deep, deep belief that came across in all of the interviews. And I think the real challenge is, you know, respecting separation of church and state and standing for that principle, which virtually everyone I interviewed in the book, you know, made very clear that was a clear part of public engagement. And then trying to figure out, is there a public place for a religious voice that still respects separation of church and state? And, you know, most of the people in the book were able to find a way to do both of those things, you know, and we have a long tradition in our country, actually, of doing both of those things. You know, Lincoln, you know, we just celebrated the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln, and you know, he was a master, I think, at doing this. You know, he would say things like his second inaugural. He would say, you know, look, we have this country, this kind of religiously divided country. In many ways, there's some parallels to our own time here where, you know, both sides in the Civil War read the same Bible, prayed to the same God, and yet, you know, came to very different conclusions. And how do you put a country back together again when there are those deep religious rifts? And I think that in many ways that we are at a kind of analogous point in our own life. And there's certainly some paths and some, you know, I certainly can respect and some pushback and saying, look, we should keep religion completely out of the public square. But that really does go beyond the separation of church and state, which is really about justifications for laws. We've always had a very vibrant public sphere with religious voices in the public sphere, just having to stop short of using them as kind of coercive instruments with the blunt force of law.
Wouldn't you agree that most progressives are grateful for the extent to which Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Rabbi Herschel took their religion into the public sphere?
Well, it's interesting. I think that you know, probably most are. I think that people don't have. I mean, one interesting little anecdote here is the liberal political philosopher John Rawls was fond of, you know, pointing to King as a good example of someone who, at first, he would talk about him as someone who had put his faith in the, or had really translated his faith into public. Into public speech without bringing too much religion in, and then when he was pressed, he had to concede that, well, in fact, he actually did bring, you know, a lot of religion into the public square, and kind of came to a realization that had really had a good outcome. But it is a really dicey. I mean, I think it's really important to say that there are some fine lines there, you know, when it's appropriate to bring it in and when it's not. And I think also most political progressives would say this, that nearly all the time, perhaps all the time, it's possible to translate one's, you know, deep beliefs into language that people who don't share those deep convictions can also understand, and that's an act of civic friendship and an act of civility that we ought to be willing to do in the public square.
Well, let's loop back to your experience at Southwestern.
Sure.
You indicated in your book that you started out an evangelical Christian and became a disillusioned Christian and now are a progressive Christian. What made, I assume that the experience at Southwestern and the takeover by the fundamentalists had something to do with your disillusionment?
Sure, yeah. You know, I mean, I was at a seminary getting a Master of Divinity degree, you know, and studying, that's the degree one gets to prepare for the ministry. And, you know, I think what I saw there was a real, really, I think, you know, the dark side of religion, where power really, where it really is more about power and control than it is about fidelity to God or to faith. And, you know, I think it took me a while to sort that out.
How did you come to that understanding? When did it hit you that that was really the issue, the underlying issue? For a young divinity student, that would seem to me to be problematic.
Well, you know, it was astonishingly easy, given that the way it happened, that it really, you know, there was sort of deceit, there was lying, there was, you know, and when the president was fired, for example, just the method in which it happened, that he was fired and escorted off campus secretly, with his personal effects locked inside while the entire student body was in chapel hearing one of the trustees preach. So there was a kind of backhandedness and under-the-tableness that, you know, certainly didn't reflect the highest of Christian values.
Well, let's talk a little bit, go back to the next segment. In your book, you indicate that in your many interviews, I would love to have been a fly on the wall when you went around the country for 3 years interviewing up to or over 100. Is that right?
Just under 100.
Just
yeah.
Under 100. Had some very interesting interviews, I'm sure. But you said that most of the leaders you interviewed on the so-called left were uneasy with that label.
Mm-hmm.
Can you summarize briefly what the reasons they offered were?
Sure. I mean, in many ways, I think it's a sign of the times that what we have witnessed and what that youth poll that I cited earlier by Barna indicates is that we have witnessed three decades of religion being the tip of the spear dividing American from American. And I think that there's a real reticence on the part of even of religious leaders who are publicly engaging and wanting to be more engaged and are gearing up to be more engaged, not to have that effect on the public. And I think particularly, you know, now I did these interviews before this economic crisis hit, but, you know, but the themes I think that come out of the last election are really about trying to get beyond, you know, red America, blue America, kind of religious versus non-religious, liberal versus conservative, and trying to kind of break down, that's the reason why the subtitle of the book has Moving Beyond the Culture Wars in it, because these leaders really were not really trying to grab a label and to push off against a polar opposite. They were really trying to do something quite different, and that was help put the country back together and really help heal the country from, I think, a lot of the harm that religion had in fact done to the country.
Well, you mentioned the economic upheaval that we're going through right now. Does it concern you that that might be a threat to your project? Let me just give you an example. I saw yesterday on CNN, Rush Limbaugh stood up and was given well over an hour of time to use CNN to address conservative right issues before CPAC in Washington. Mm-hmm. He was then followed by Ann Coulter.
Right.
Have we really gotten to a post-religious right world, do you think?
Right. Well, this is a good point. I certainly don't want to be too definitive about, you know, I'm not proclaiming, and I think E.J. Dionne and others have been right about saying, look, you know, the Christian right is not dead. That's not what we're saying, and conservative religion in America is not dead. And I should be clear that, you know, I don't think conservative religion in America should be dead. Like, that's not the point of the book. The point of the book is that there is a much broader religious tradition, and that democracy is much healthier when all of the religious voices, conservative, moderate, progressive, are all in the public square, you know, and doing it in appropriate ways. That's the healthy thing that Madison, you know, envisioned for the country, that, you know, the different kind of perspectives and voices would actually help keep one another in check, that's a much healthier system. But there are some pieces of evidence that things are shifting. You know, one, you know, so if you look at the kind of some of the big names that really were, that really built the Christian right, there's an aging going on, so that we have lost James Kennedy, Reverend Falwell have died. The Christian Coalition is basically bankrupt. The Moral Majority is no longer on the scene.
Robertson has retired for the most part. Pat Robertson has mostly retired.
Right, and just this past week, James Dobson stepped down as the head of Focus on the Family, which is by far the largest organization on the Christian right. Now, he's going to still continue to do some things, but he did, you know, he's 72 years old and did basically officially retire from the board. And also Focus on the Family has laid off for the first time in its history, as far as I know, laid off people this year. So there are some signs that, you know, as Jim Wallis of Sojourners was kind of famous for putting it, that the monologue of the religious right is over. And I think that's more of what I mean, that it's no longer going to be a monologue, but there's going to be a much broader array of voices in the public square.
You say that progressives, and you count yourself in this category, are reluctant to brand one religious tradition or another as truly Christian, along with Lincoln, who said divine purposes always transcend human aims. But on the other hand, you also say that you criticize conservative Christians by saying they've, quote, drunk too deeply at the well of power.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely expression. I guess my question is that consistent? Let me just give you a few examples. Are theocratic Christians truly Christian or pro-slavery Christians back in 1865? Mm-hmm. Libertarian Christians who agree they should care for the poor but disagree that government should force citizens to do so and so on and so on?
Yeah. Well, certainly I'm not in a position to make that make that judgment. I would sort of retreat back and say, you know, it's certainly the case that sort of only the divine knows, you know, or only God knows who true Christians or true Jews or, you know, true Hindus or whoever are. That's certainly not, you know, my case to do it. But I do think your point goes to, I think, something that should really give, you know, all of us in every contemporary debate pause to really kind of step back. And, you know, Lincoln's words, you know, that I had cited earlier are right on. And when you take it really seriously that, you know, people who claimed, you know, true Christianity were, you know, as Lincoln put it, read the same Bible, prayed to the same God, both thought they were equally right on the issue of slavery. And, you know, obviously, from our vantage point, we have a clear judgment that those who were for slavery were wrong. But at the time, 150 years ago, that wasn't so clear. And I think, you know, that's something to really take into account today, that the debates where there's deep, deep disagreement, that, you know, the status quo may not be what history is going to judge to be right.
Well, I guess my question is, when the word inclusive is used and respectful of all religious traditions, beliefs, and values, those are some of the words that you find in the various pronunciations of progressive manifestos. Isn't this just another way of being timid and not being clear?
Maybe. I think there's a real danger there. I really do. I think you're right to point this out. And, you know, I think the thing that I'm thinking of Rabbi Marla Feldman, who I interviewed in the book, who is with the Reform Judaism, who said, you know, on this very point that, you know, one thing she was learning to do was to say, and to kind of use this as a metaphor, look, I stood at Sinai too. I heard, you know, I hear sort of the word of God too. And this is what I take it, you know, with the best judgment I can bring to it and the best discernment I can muster, it's leading me this direction. And that puts me in strong disagreement with you. And so I think the things that are happening is a way of coming to, you know, strong disagreements, but maybe stopping quite short of absolute, you know, having a sense of absolute truth. One other person, Reverend James Fords, who's an African-American Christian minister, had this lovely phrase that he said, you know, we don't have all of the truth just because we hold the Bible in our hands. What we get is a peek through the window of truth. And God's the only one who really knows the truth. And I think, but it's a delicate thing to hang on to that sentiment and that kind of humility, and also be able to take a strong stand that says, but as best I can see, this is what God requires of us, you know, in our time.
Well, we've got about 13, 14 more minutes, and I'm going to give you a chance to take a breather and do some announcements here. When we come back, I'd like to ask you who were your most interesting or provocative or maybe even inspiring of the people that you interviewed. But before we go there, Carly, I think we have a couple of announcements we want to get on the air.
Yes, we do. On Sunday, March 15th, at the University YMCA in Champaign is the annual International Dinner. It's held each spring in partnership with the Cosmopolitan Club, the Office of International Student Affairs, and the University of Illinois YMCA. And tickets went on sale February 23rd and can be purchased at the University YMCA. And once again, that is on March 15th. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. Tickets are $8, and you can get them at the University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. And you can go to the universityymca.org website if you also want to find out some more information about that. And then also coming up this week, we have the Islam Awareness Week, which is going on here in town. And let's see here, on Monday, which is tomorrow, we have The Colors of Islam. It's presented by Professor Nahar, an SIUC School of Art and Design professor. It's at the SIUC School of Art and Design, the Lincoln Hall. And on Tuesday is the Muslim Mosaic. It's at the Alina Union Colonial Room, and that's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then there's an interfaith variety show at the Allen Hall Main Lounge at 7 p.m. And then on Wednesday, March 4th, there's the History, Roles, and Contemporary Challenges of American Muslims, and that's at the Lincoln Hall at room 192 at 7 p.m. And then on Thursday, March 5th, is the Unveiling Islam, Anything and Everything, and that's at the Lincoln Hall at room 192 at 7 p.m. And then on Friday is an open house at the Central Illinois Mosque and Islam Center at 106 South Lincoln Street in Urbana, and that's from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. And that's, again, the open house at the Central Illinois Mosque and Islam Center at 106 South Lincoln from 12:30 to 2:30. So if you are interested in learning some more about Islam, that would be something to check out.
Thank you, Carly.
Mm-hmm.
She obviously has had radio experience, right? You got that rich, mellow voice.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate it. If you just tuned in late, we are talking with Professor Robert P. Jones, who has written a book entitled Progressive and Religious, How Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and Buddhist Leaders Are Moving Beyond the Culture Wars and Transforming American Life. A very provocative and good read. Professor Jones spent 3 years going around the country interviewing a number of people, almost 100, on the progressive side of the religious equation. And I was just curious, Professor Jones, who were your favorite interviews? Who are those that stick in your mind that you can't forget?
Well, it's hard. I mean, it was a really amazingly rich experience. I'd really not, I think, anticipated how rich a personal experience it would be just getting to sit across.
It must have been.
From so many people who are doing so many amazing things. So it'll be tough to pick, but I'll point to a couple. I know our time is short. One thing I would want to point out just before we jump in there is that I have made available, if any of your listeners would like to hear these people in their own voices, audio podcasts that are available on iTunes and also available at progressiveandreligious.org.
www.progressiveandreligious.org,
all spelled out together. So you can actually, they're free, you can download them, but you can actually hear many of the leaders I've been talking about speaking in their own voice, and I've edited down them into about 8-minute segments.
Can I just hold you 1 second? We do have a caller on line one.
Oh, great.
We don't want to keep
sure.
them waiting. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you got any sort of information about how progressives are thinking, especially in particular about the environment and what they are how they are using their faith, their religion, to justify ecological points of view. I mean, I know how I would do that with my faith, but I'm curious if you got any sort of feedback from progressive Christians or Jews or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I know less about Muslims about that. And also, I guess another thought I have, a perception I have, is that right-wing Christians are more pro-business, and that left-wing agendas, in particular ecological agendas, global warming, et cetera, are less, quote-unquote, pro-business, and that there is some reality to that, that they're to simplifying our lives and pursuing ecological agendas means inevitably less profits for somebody. And so I wondered what you thought about those two things. I'll hang up and
Thank you for your call, Professor
Great.
Jones.
Sure. One thing I think is happening in the environmental movement that I find really interesting is that I do think there has been a juxtaposition where you choose, right? You have economic prosperity or environmental protection, and it's a zero-sum game. You trade one off another. And I think we're moving past that in many ways, that the idea of that green jobs, that actually moving forward on the environment can create new jobs, so that it's not pitting economic prosperity against protecting the environment, is one thing that's happening. The other thing I would point to is I did it in a variety of traditions. I'll point to a few. There's a whole creation care movement among evangelicals, Reverend Joel Hunter, Rich Cizik, who was formerly at the NAE, who have really been pushing evangelicals to think sort of beyond what is typically a more of an individualist faith, but to really take a more social view of their faith. Two others I'll bring. One concept, I'm happy this caller brought this up, that this concept of this is a Jewish concept called tikkun olam, and it means to heal the world. And many times that's talked about in social justice terms, but I also heard it talked about in a more holistic way, and that is to use the world not just metaphorically to talk about all human beings, but literally the world, and that concept, which is very, very deep in contemporary Judaism, this idea that we have a responsibility to be co-laborers with God to bring about the healing of the world, that's the divine human project, is this kind of cooperation. And the other places in Buddhism that I heard over and over, but this real sense of, in Buddhism, there's a kind of connectedness not only to the oneness of humanity, but to the oneness of all beings, so animals and plants and the planet. There's this sense of a connectedness to the whole, and that really it's impossible from that religious viewpoint for a piece of that to prosper at the expense of another, because everything is so interdependent and so connected. And so I think that's a very powerful way of thinking about the environment as well. But the environment absolutely is a very strong theme throughout, I think, progressive religion.
You mentioned tikkun when you were talking about recovering passion earlier. I can't imagine anyone more passionate than Rabbi Michael Lerner associated with tikkun. Is that you interviewed him personally?
I did, yeah. I went out to Oakland and interviewed him at his home in
is
Oakland.
Is he as lively in person as when he's
giving
a speech?
He is very lively, yes. I think a real master at putting out a vision, and I think one of the things that was striking about what he talked about was saying, on this issue of timidity, that's been kind of a theme of our conversation today, when he said, when I speak to college graduating classes and that sort of thing, I tell them, forget about being realistic, go for what you think, hold out for the vision, hold out for mm-hmm. the world that you really want to see. And I think that sense of putting forward a vision and really helping people move toward a better world and healing a world toward that goal is a real contribution to that progressive religious voices are bringing to the country.
Well, you were going to talk to us a little bit about your top two or three. Let's just why don't you just pick two, because I want to make sure we get to our last questions about your vision of our ideal future for interfaith relations in this country. Who are your favorite interviews?
Well, I'll give you one that's a little bit of it's just a little personal, but I actually ran into Alan Sinaki, who's a Zoto Zen priest outside of Berkeley, who had this very interesting mix, and I think this goes to how a lot of progressive religious leaders do integrate a lot of different traditions. But so he's trained as a Buddhist priest, and was head of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship for a while. But he also plays traditional Appalachian folk music. And in fact, knew my cousin Carl, who also does the same thing. So I think that was probably one of the more memorable moments. I got to hear him sing a Buddhist version of "Just a Closer Walk with Thee," which, by the way, I have I have a podcast of him up singing that on the website. So
that bends my brain.
If anyone is interested in hearing a Buddhist version of "Just a Closer Walk with Thee," it's a thing to hear.
It's on there.
It's at the very end of the podcast.
All right, one more.
Yeah, and I think one thing I'll say about him too, just and then I'll jump over, is he had this very simple line that he said, "To me, the Buddhist precepts boil down to not living your life at the expense of other beings," and that was really the center of kind of how he organized his life, which I thought was very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I'll point to is Rabbi Sharon Brous, young female rabbi out in L.A., and as someone who really is, I think, blazing a trail and integrating a new kind of spirituality along with social justice and community organizing, really quite remarkable. She talked about experience of Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, that, you know, for Jews, she said, we engage in the world for 6 days and then engage, that Shabbat really is a place of engaging in the dream of what the world ought to be like for one day a week, and that what we should do then is to allow the inspiration from that experience to push us back into the world with a renewed commitment, and here's her, I'll quote her on the end here, with a renewed commitment to go out and lift the line of history so it matches that dream.
You end your book with an interesting chapter, and we've just got about barely a minute and a half here.
Yep.
You talk about your vision of an ideal future of interfaith relations, and you mentioned five principles that the progressive religious movement can focus on, emphasis on social injustice, a relational approach to truth, critical engagement with tradition, profound belief in the unity of all humanity, and a new vision of America emphasizing generosity and interdependence. Can you give us about 40 seconds of what you mean by the last one? What's a new vision of America emphasizing generosity and interdependence that Rush Limbaugh could buy?
Sure. that's a great closer, I think. I didn't actually ask about this in the interviews, but it's something that some things I asked about. This one actually just kept coming up. And one of the things that people, I think, kept calling for is a rethinking of America and the world, America's role in the world. I mean, we have this kind of Christian thing from John Winthrop, a city set on a hill that I think Reagan has used often, and it's been invoked by various presidents across time. But really rethinking what many of the religious leaders that I talked about was something I called in the book a prophetic patriotism that really moves away from this sense of America as empire to America that's more interdependent with other countries, more generous with other countries, and this idea that critiquing one's country when it has lost its, you know, when it's moving away from its ideals is, in fact, an act of patriotism and an act of being a faithful religious person.
Well, Professor Jones, this has been a provocative and interesting conversation. I had about 50 other questions to ask you. Hope you can come to Champaign-Urbana sometime so we can continue the conversation. Appreciate your being with us. We've been talking with Professor Robert P. Jones, who's just written a book called Progressive and Religious. And what's that website again?
www.progressiveandreligious.org.
Interesting site. Thank you very much for a lovely and interesting discussion.
Well, thank you very much.
Good afternoon. And
can white guys be hip? Compare Bob Dylan, Lenny Bruce, even Jack Kerouac to Miles Davis, and you have to wonder if they're really just hipster wannabes. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the history of hip and how it's so often tied into race. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This evening at 7. Coming up March 9th on WILL-TV, another live cooking show. Hi, I'm David Inge. Join me Monday, March 9th, as we cook up some comfort food, great chili, soup, and stew recipes. Plus, find out how to get your own copy of the cookbook. That's Chili, Soups, and Stews, coming up March 9th on WILL-TV.
WILL programs are funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, performing computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventive maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service is also